For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time for This Week in Oklahoma Politics with ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel and Republican political consultant Neva Hill. Well, this week has seen a massive shakeup in the State Health Department. Commissioner Terry Klein resigned, along with Deputy Kelly Cox Kane. Finance Secretary Preston Dorflinger moved in as interim commissioner and immediately fired the agency's chief lawyer. Ryan, this is quite a change for one of Oklahoma's biggest agencies.
Biggest and one of the most important agencies, and the number of services they deliver to the most vulnerable populations in the state of Oklahoma. And it couldn't come at a worse time. And we're talking about an agency that's seen a double digit in the millions, nearly 30 million in cuts since 2009, and on top of additional cuts, even in years where they were able to maintain, you know, some, you know, neutral amount of cuts in the legislature. They're still hurting, and people are still needing these services. The turmoil here, again, could not come at a worse time. I'm glad to see Preston Dorflinger over there. You know, he's somebody who politically I disagree with on a number of issues, but he's, most accounts, a solid administrator, and I think that he's going to be able to try to get to the bottom of this very quickly.
And Neva?
Well, it's interesting. This is something that started, I guess, in September when the agency requested the auditor and inspector to begin to come in to look at what was going on. And I think clearly even the auditor said this week that it takes time to kind of get this teed up and get ready to do this. They were speculating that it could be the end of February, probably before they get at least the initial audit findings back. It raises a lot of questions. I mean, as you say, I mean, the seriousness of the mismanagement and the fact that many speculate that this could involve federal funds as well as state funds, which opens up a whole nother can of worms in terms of what the potential problems could be and what the accounting could be at the end of all of that. So, I mean, we have kind of a shifting narrative now, unfortunately, you know, for many in the fact that we're now talking about rather than underfunded agencies, we're talking about mismanagement of funds in these agencies. And that's going to change, I think, a lot of the discussion with these lawmakers, because it's a little different narrative than what we've been sensing and seeing and hearing about for weeks and months now. So how that plays not only ending this special session, if we ever get out of it, and what that looks like for the upcoming session, I think that's a big question in my mind.
One of the things the Oklahoman found out was that people had reported, mm-hmm. Whistleblowers had reported to then Attorney General Scott Pruitt 3 years ago, but it's not clear if he did anything. Do you think it's a problem that basically people have been talking about this and nothing really seems to have been done about it for 3 years?
Well, first I want to correct, I said 29 million, 29% in their right. budget cuts since 2009, not 29 million. So even bigger numbers that we're talking about there. The 2014, 2015 whistleblower reports to the Attorney General's office. Scott Pruitt, from all we can tell, the only action that has been reported so far is that they actually turned that back over to DHS, which seems to me to the absolute wrong move. If you're receiving reports of impropriety and mismanagement and possibly illegal conduct happening at an agency, the last thing you want to do is to give those reports back to that agency and allow the leadership there to investigate themselves. We'll see as this unfolds what the AG's office actually did. There has, you had the office turnover, and so if this was off the table, the new folks in the AG's office may not even have known that there was a problem. Maybe if the whistleblower had put it on Devin Letterhead, Scott Pruitt would have paid a little bit more of attention to it.
Devin, do you think more should have been done on that?
Well, I mean, I think that will unfold and we'll see what the claims were, what the assertions were, whether they should have been addressed in some different manner. I mean, I think that's what this whole process will now unfold. Mm-hmm.
It's been an interesting week at the state capitol as a grand bargain to fix the budget failed on a tie vote in committee last week. Since then, the House and Senate have passed patches to the loss of $215 million in cigarette fees. The governor is getting a bill to take $23 million from the state's rainy day fund, and the Senate is getting a bill to increase gross production taxes on old oil wells from 2% to 4%. Neva, what do you think about all this?
I think who's on first? I mean, it is hard, even if you're trying to follow it with some level of seriousness and try to figure out what's going on. It's such a moving target, and I think it's even confusing. It's clear this week to many of these lawmakers who are trying to trying to just keep track of what are we voting on. I mean, when you have 3 hours of amendments and debate, as we saw in the House this week, I mean, it becomes, especially for that large number of freshman lawmakers, I mean, this is a process that I'm sure has many of their heads really spinning. And bottom line, are we any closer to any real resolution to the seriousness of dealing with the shortfall and moving forward? No. And even more kind of astounding is when you think about it, the legislature is just 5 weeks now away from their first deadline, which is for the regular session, yeah, with their first deadline on bill requests. So, I mean, in the midst of all of this, what would normally be the normal kind of startup for the next session is being totally mired in the mess, and I think it's going to create for just further chaos in the upcoming session.
Ryan.
Well, further chaos and I think further cuts. You know, we're already looking right now at starting the next legislative session, the next regular session in 2018, with a $500 million hole. And that's the best case scenario that we're looking at right now. Neva's right, who's on first. This is one of the most convoluted 10 days in the Oklahoma legislature that I could ever remember. And you see seasoned veterans at the Capitol scrambling to try to keep up with where things are at. Michael, you mentioned that an attempt at a grand bargain on Friday and then some other attempts at a grand bargain earlier this week, mm-hmm, failed in the legislature. And some real high drama on the House floor on Wednesday. It was pretty incredible to watch unfold. But I would say that it really wasn't a grand bargain at all. I think that we can't really call it that because it seems now, especially with the votes on amendments that happened on Wednesday, that the Republicans in committee on last week on Friday were really trying to set the Democrats up. They wanted to put the Democrats in a position where they had to approve, they had to go on the board with a bill that the Republican leadership never intended on allowing to have a vote. And we saw that really come true yesterday when Democrats and some Republicans got within two votes on two amendments to pass what was essentially the same plan that was up in committee on Friday that failed in an 11-11 tie with seven Republicans abstaining and only one Democrat joining the yes votes. It's incredibly confusing, but I think that the likelihood that we walk out of this legislative session with any sort of a roadmap of where we're going to begin to close our massive budget crisis, that's just not going to happen now.
And I think the other thing is what I think both Republicans and Democrats have not really come to terms with is the fact that there are no winners in all of this. I mean, this posturing back and forth, the gotcha game of we're going to get it for the Democrats, try to force the Republicans to make a certain kind of vote, the Republicans trying to get the Democrats on the record, trying to, you know, make their stand. None of that's working. And the bottom line is, in the polls that are out there right now, I've seen the number 67% of Oklahomans saying that the legislature, the composite group, all of them are the problem, and that they're blaming it on everyone. So when you have that kind of setup, when they're now beginning to say, okay, we don't know what to believe. I mean, do they really have enough money or don't they have enough money? What are they doing with the money? And all of these questions get thrown into the mix. I mean, it makes for a very difficult setup. And you're right. I mean, coming into 2018 and no plan, I think both the House and the Senate, memberships in both bodies better go to retreats somewhere, you know, very soon and come up with a plan and then hopefully be able to sit down with the governor and work out something that is good for Oklahomans rather than just this political chaos.
Go ahead, Michael.
Well, do you think the loss of Scott Inman last week might have affected that 11-11 vote on Friday?
Absolutely it did. I mean, you saw kind of a leadership team of Emily Virgin, Eric Proctor, and Corey Williams and Steve Copeland, I think, scrambling to try to come up with a coherent strategy. And, I think that they did the best that they could do in that situation. I mean, frankly, you know, what we've got right now is the Republican leadership in the House holding a can of gasoline in one hand, matches in the other, and the Daily Oklahoman, trying to seriously say that it was the Democrats that started the fire. And that's where we are right now. This, you know, Leader Inman leaving last week, I'm sure shook up the Democratic caucus, but this is a fight that leadership in that caucus have been in for a very, very long time.
And they seem intractable wanting to move off of that fight. And that I think is one of the difficulties. I mean, they had an opportunity to kind of have a reset and say, okay, you know, know, let's all step back and let's just find a middle ground that we can all hold our nose and vote on and get something done and get out of here.
I think,
and they weren't willing to do it either. So, I mean, there's culpability on both sides, but the Democrats had a real opportunity to kind of step up and try to reclaim some of the ground that clearly they've lost in this debate and didn't do it.
And I think we can talk about, you know, the Democrats, you know, whether last Friday was a misstep or not, to me seems to be beside the point, because a majority, both in the legislature and among Oklahomans, seem to agree that gross production tax needs to be on the table. You have the Senate with a bipartisan resolution coming out of the Senate telling the House that they want to do this. You've got the governor in many instances indicating that she wants to do this. You have Republicans joining Democrats in amendment fights yesterday where they wouldn't even allow the actual amendments to come up for a vote. They were all tabled, but two of those amendments came within two votes of actually being up to come up for a vote. There you had Republicans joining with Democrats in the House. The real obstacle right now, I think, seems to be House leadership and Speaker Charles McCall.
Well, and the GPT question no longer is, are they going to vote or not going to vote on issues? It's what and how much and when. So, I mean, there's been a movement on that. I mean, it's not this intractable position of absolutely there's no conversation. And bottom line is, I mean, the more convoluted it gets, I think the more difficult it gets even for Oklahomans to understand. They bought into the need that we must have more money and that somehow this was going to be the quick fix to get it done. But I think the longer this goes, the more they're going to start to question and see the validity of some of the arguments why that was not a good move to start with.
Interesting story to follow here, and I'm sure we'll be talking about it in the months to come, is that over the last 5 weeks of this special session, we've seen growing tension among different factions in the oil and gas community. And, you know, now you see a group out there pushing for a ballot question that would actually raise the gross production tax up to 7% on all wells. And they're a split from the Oklahoma Independent Petroleum Association. So you've got small producers versus mid-sized producers versus
no
large
different
producers.
Than big business versus small business, right? Or, you know, small labor, you know, contractors versus big labor. I mean, it goes with the territory. So I don't think that's that unusual.
Yeah, I'm sure we'll be talking about this next week. The state Supreme Court halts a new DUI law while it considers its constitutionality. The most controversial parts of the measure allow law enforcement to destroy a person's driver's license upon arrest for DUI and punish people who refuse to take blood alcohol tests. Ryan, do you think this law will be added to the long list of laws shot down by the high court this year?
I think if you look at the number of justices that agreed to hear this case, that agreed with the injunction to keep it from going into effect, I think that there's a high likelihood that all are part of this legislation could be struck down. I mean, even the governor seemed to recognize when she signed the law into effect that there were problems with it. You know, the Supreme Court has recognized that your driver's license is a property right that you have as an Oklahoman. And if, you know, the state can take it away from you, there, you know, any number of instances in which the state can take that away from you, but you have to have due process. You have to have a hearing in place. And this law took away that opportunity to have a hearing before the Department of Public Safety and allowed for an immediate seizure and destruction of your driver's license. And the governor, whenever she signed this, issued an executive order at the same time saying that we're going to reinstate the hearing process. Well, you know, that's legislating from the executive office. That's more than implementation. And, you know, I think that she recognized the problem here. She liked the underlying effect of the law and wanted it to go to become law. And so she signed it. I think what she probably should have done here is veto it, sent a veto message back to the legislature saying, you know, good job, but let's get this right. Let's not violate the Constitution as we're trying to make our streets and roads safer.
It also seems like there's multiple subjects in this. So there could be a lot of things fighting this.
Absolutely.
Law.
Yeah. And I think with 2 days before it was going to be enacted into law, the fact that there was the 6-2 ruling by the Supreme Court, right, I think is significant. And I mean, this would be the fifth time that the court has come in and this year and had to consider something challenging the constitutionality of a law. So these are serious issues. And I think Ryan raised the issue with respect to the governor. I mean, one of the things that that is being claimed in all of this is the fact that she was overstepping her role by attempting to legislate after the fact with the statements that were made. So there are a lot of issues. I mean, the single subject rule, I mean, all of these things that are coming into play. But bottom line is, As legislation is passed, I think it is becoming incumbent upon every lawmaker out there to recognize the seriousness of following the Constitution and not finding ways to try to circumvent or get around it and hope that it works. Let's start with the premise that, first of all, we want these laws to be constitutional and pass constitutional muster.
And, you know, one of the authors of this bill, Representative Scott Biggs, he's an attorney. I mean, he should have known better. I mean, you know, due process isn't, you know, some advanced course or an elective in law school. It's a basic fundamental principle of constitutional law. He should have known better whenever he wrote this
legislation. You know, and ironically, and we're seeing it in the numbers of these candidates now coming forward for the next election, there was a stigma for a while with attorneys in the legislature that running, and particularly even Republicans, had this notion that we don't need attorneys in the legislature. We have too many attorneys in the legislature, which, of course, is a falsehood. I mean, there statistically, there are not that many, but we are seeing more of these attorneys come forward, you know, wanting to run for these legislative positions next year. And I think some of that stems from the fact that even inside the Capitol building, you hear that many of these things perhaps could have been avoided if they had had more lawmakers with that background, at least in some measure in these committees and in this process. So some of this could have clearly been debated and articulated in advance and not coming after the fact.
Lawmakers with a background in law.
What a novel idea.
Last week, we learned of Scott Inman dropping out of the race for governor, and now we know Oklahoma County Commissioner Brian Mann is dropping out of the race for Oklahoma City mayor after complications from a summer car accident. Neva, does this clear the way for Senator David Holt to take this job?
Well, I mean, it certainly makes it a clearer path than a week ago, and I think as Commissioner Mann said, he did it early enough, having made his decision, that it does afford an opportunity before the December filing comes. For other folks to take another look at it or look at it for the first time. So it remains to be seen whether this is just a foregone conclusion, whether there's going to be a competitive race or not. But Commissioner Mann clearly has 3 years left on his term. Mm-hmm. He's going to continue to fulfill his duties at the courthouse. So it just was a case where he made a decision based on personal circumstances to step away from the mayoral bid.
Ryan, City Councilman Ed Shadid has said he's also possibly running. Could he bring a challenge to Senator Holt?
You know, I think so. I mean, he would be a strong candidate. He's received, whenever he ran against Mayor Mick Cornett, he received a record number of votes for somebody who didn't actually win the race. I mean, there's a huge turnout. He's got a strong following here in Oklahoma City. I think that if he gets in the race, he immediately becomes a formidable opponent to David Holt. David Holt, of course, has been a fundraising juggernaut. He has endorsements from across the political spectrum right now. That makes him a very difficult person to beat. And he is by all accounts, the presumptive favorite in this race. But at the end of the day, elections aren't won by your campaign war chest. The elections aren't won by endorsements. They're won by identifying your supporters and making sure they turn out on election day. And I don't think that there is any politician in the state of Oklahoma who is better at doing that than Ed Shadid. Ed Shadid, both himself and the campaign team of his advisors that are around him, are better at targeting voters and getting them to show up on election day than any other candidate in the state of Oklahoma right now. So that said, you know, if he gets in, I think that Senator Holt has something to worry about. But Brian Mann leaving the race, I think that it makes it easier for David Holt, but I don't think that Brian Mann was ever the person that was going to defeat David Holt at the ballot box.
You know, it's interesting. We're talking 4 months till the election.
Right.
So, I mean, they're on a very fast track right now. And anyone that is looking at it, whether it's Councilman Shadid or anyone else, I mean, they have got to hit the ground running, and they've got to probably do it with double time, given the fact that, as we've talked about, I mean, Holt's had a tremendous advantage in the fundraising effort. And not to say that that can't be overcome, and not to say that that's the exclusive factor dictating the outcome, but in a race in February, with a low voter turnout, as we know, in municipal elections, it is about the ground game. And anyone that can come in instantly and be able to galvanize a group of people, they're going to be competitive, and no one's going to discount their ability to wage a serious campaign. But I think they've got days, not weeks, to make that decision.
Absolutely.
And much like we saw in Tulsa, although, nonpartisan race, it's obvious
nonpartisan, but partisan.
Yeah, which side these guys are on.
Right.
Well, and I think, you know, with Brian Mann in the race, it didn't really, you know, David Holt has this unique, and much like Mayor Cornett, he has a lot of support from Democratic constituencies, progressive constituencies. I think, you know, Brian Mann being in the race, he doesn't really cut into that at all. And, you know, so David Holt brings enough Republicans with him and enough progressives and Democrats with him that a candidate like Brian Mann isn't that serious of a threat to him being mayor. Ed Shadid gets in the race, that dynamic changes overnight.
Right. Pulls a lot of maybe
pulls a lot of the progressives, right. A lot of the Democrats and independents, yeah.
Congressman Jim Bridenstine gets grilled in the Senate in his bid to head the space agency NASA. Democrats attacked Bridenstine about climate change, gay rights, and his fiscal management of the Tulsa Air and Space Museum. Ryan, the minority party seems to feel he's not qualified to do the job, but will it keep him from getting confirmed?
It seems doubtful. Even Senator Bill Nelson, who former astronaut, Florida Democrat, somebody ranking member of this committee and somebody who has, you know, probably in all of Congress, a better handle of what NASA is and how NASA should operate than any other member. Even he, after the committee, said he wasn't disclosing how he was going to vote. So he wasn't an outright no to Jim Bridenstine. But he and several other members did call out his, you know, their deep reservation about his ability to administer this agency. And I think that, you know, some of that deals with the political divisiveness that Bridenstine has brought to his congressional campaign and to his time in Congress. And NASA is, you know, hopefully one of, and remains somewhat one of the most insulated government agencies from the political polarization that we've seen. And to put a political figure there rather than a scientist and an administrator, somebody who has a background in both of those, who has, you know, largely led a nonpartisan life, that is a change. And I also think that just from an administrative standpoint, to walk in, there's a big difference from operating an Air and Space Museum in Oklahoma and serving as a member of Congress and being a fighter pilot, all of which are admirable things, and running one of the largest, most technical agencies in the country, and one that's charged with things that, frankly, Representative Bridenstine doesn't have that great of a record on, including climate change.
Neva, politics aside, Bridenstine certainly does have a lot of respect for the agency and its mission.
Absolutely. And I think what we had with the confirmation hearing was what we would expect. I mean, we had the Democrats taking on the Republican who had been put forward as the administration choice, and they put Bridenstine through the paces. I would agree with Ryan that while we don't know what the vote will be, it appears that the tracking is that Bridenstine, in fact, will make it through the confirmation process and will become the next NASA administrator. This conversation about the fact that that he's political versus a scientist or an academic or what we've had in some of the previous administrators, I think one of the points that he made that was very well taken during the confirmation process was that in the 1960s, James Webb, who's one of the legendary NASA figures as an administrator, was a political operative when he came in to NASA and shepherded through one of the most significant times in space exploration and the program here in the United States. So I think Bridenstine, throughout his time in Congress, has shown an interest and an expertise developing in this area. I think he's someone that clearly was well vetted to get to this point from the administration standpoint of being their selection. They had a wide array of applicants and people that were interested in this position. He became the pick, and I think we'll see him ultimately likely to be the administrator.
Ryan, he seemed to actually kind of walk back some of his thoughts on climate change, did actually admit from the transcript that climate change was real and man-made cause. He didn't say how much, but certainly at least it seemed to say that the climate change was real and man-made.
Which is somewhat reassuring, but I mean, that's a pretty low bar to set for the person that's going to be the administrator of NASA, who among their various charges is to observe climate change around the world, around the globe. That's part of their mission. And to me, the bigger concern with Representative Bridenstine is just his ability to serve as an administrator. You know, we do have this political appointee who's coming in who doesn't have any sort of a background in administering any sort of an agency like this. I know that he has a deep interest in NASA, and I appreciate that. I don't think that he walks in there with any sort of a nefarious mission. But as a political figure without the administrative and scientific expertise to run this agency, I'm concerned about where it heads over the next several
years. And this
years.
Is the role of most administrators and most agencies, because it is the political framework from which the administration operates. I mean, administration comes in, they have the opportunity to put people in place at the top levels. Those people make sure that the folks, frankly, that are the career folks in these agencies continue on if they're doing what is acceptable with the change in policy or philosophy of the new administration. And I think it is significant, probably didn't get the credit from his opponents, but vowing to say that he will not allow politics to basically interfere with the science, even if it rubs up against the administration to some degree, I think was a significant overture in the confirmation hearing, and something that, quite frankly, I think a lot of Republicans didn't expect to hear.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.